For argument, James River Insurance Company versus Kemper. Mr. Reeses.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michael Reeses, and I'm here today on behalf of the appellant James River Insurance Company. This is an appeal from an order of the district court finding that James River owed a duty to defend an underlying lawsuit brought by Lisa Terranova. We've raised three exclusions on appeal. Because any of those exclusions is a complete defense to coverage, we respectfully submit the judgment below cannot stand. The first exclusion we want you to consider today is the so-called prior policy exclusion in Section 3A2 of the policy, quoted at length on page 11 of our brief. It provides that the policy does not apply to any claim, quote, based on or directly or indirectly arising from any common fact, circumstance, transaction, advice, or decision in a professional service reported as a claim under any prior policy. First, let's focus on the last two words, prior policy. The word prior in prior policy refers to a policy issued before the James River policy, which picked up coverage for wrongful acts that took place on or after the retroactive date of November 8, 2002.
What was the cover period for Kemper?
The Kemper policy period was between September 27, 2000 and September 27, 2002. It covered errors or omissions in professional services that took place within those two dates. And our position is very simple. September 27, 2002, when that policy period ends, is prior to November 8, 2002, when our policy picks up coverage for wrongful acts that are then made and reported within our claims reporting policy period of November 8, 2004 to November 8, 2005.
I'm sorry, I thought you said 2002.
That's our retroactive date. We pick up coverage for wrongful acts that take place on or after November 8, 2002, but then the claim is...
The claim has to be filed
after
2004.
Correct.
I see.
Correct. Now, by a separate endorsement and...
So was their claim, was the claim filed after November 8, 2004?
Yes, the original lawsuit was filed April 20, 2005.
Right.
Okay.
Was that the first notice?
The first notice would have been about 12 days later on or about May 2.
Well, I'm talking about with all this going on and dispute and whatever.
Yes, that was our first notice to us, yes.
The law firm didn't notify at least it didn't notify your firm.
Correct.
Did it notify Kemper earlier? Or do you know?
I don't think the record really says one way or the other.
No.
But now, here's also what's important as far as the Kemper policy. There is a separate endorsement to the Kemper policy, and in exchange for an additional premium of about $48,000, the period for reporting claims to Kemper was extended by 5 years, from September 27, 2002 to September 27, 2007. And this is what is the most important thing of all. The Kemper extended reporting endorsement did not change the policy period. It only enlarged the period of time in which to report a claim to Kemper.
That occurred within that 2000 to 2002 period?
I'm sorry, what occurred?
To report a claim of something that occurred?
Between September date.
Correct. The extended endorsement would apply only to a wrongful act that took place between September 27, 2000 and September 27, 2002. So the endorsement did not extend the policy period. It only extended the reporting period in which to report a claim that was based on a wrongful act that took place between September 27, 2000 and September 27, 2002.
Okay, so turning to the Terra Nova suit.
Yes.
So what events occurred, you know, between September 27, 2000, September 27, 2002, and then what additional conduct occurred
first
during
that
period?
The initial failure to transfer the stock options before they became worthless by reason of the bankruptcy filing. They became worthless on or about July 16, 2001. So the failure to effect a transfer before that date falls within the Kemper policy period. Then you have the second wrongful act, which was that the defendants, the Ranella defendants, filed a petition for rule to show cause based on the failure to effect the transfer. That was in April of 2001. The third wrongful act took place after the petition was denied, and they appealed. That was in the fall of 2001.
I missed that. The third wrongful act was what?
The appeal of the denial of the rule to show cause based on the failure to transfer the stock options.
And
that's in the fall of 2001. We're still within the Kemper policy period. Now, the fourth and fifth wrongful acts, which we acknowledge took place after our retroactive date of November 8, 2002, would be the failure to tell the clients about our defendant's wrongful conduct, the cover-up and the conspiracy. Okay. Fine. That all takes place after our retroactive date. But the exclusion says that there is no coverage for a claim that is based upon, okay, a common fact, circumstance, transaction advice, or decision in a professional service that's reported as a claim under a prior policy. Our position here is very simple, that the common fact or circumstance was the initial failure to transfer the stock options before they became worthless. That was within their policy period in 2001, and it was reported under their extended reporting endorsement in 2005. Our position is very simple. A policy that ends for wrongful, you know, for the coverage on September 27, 2002, has to be prior to a policy that doesn't pick up for wrongful acts until November 8 of 2002.
So it all stems from the one original claim.
It all stems, the common factor circumstances, the failure to transfer the stock before, or the stock options before it became worthless. Why is the petition for rule to show cause filed? Because there was no effective transfer. Why do they appeal from the denial of the petition? Because there was no effective transfer. What was there to cover up or conspire about? The failure to tell her about their the failure to tell her that she had a lawsuit based upon their failure to effect the transfer of the stock options. If you will pardon the expression, the initial failure to transfer the stock options is the mother of all wrongful acts here. And it all falls within our exclusion because their policy is prior to our policy and the claim was reported to them and there is a common fact or circumstance involved.
And all of this is focused on duty to defend.
Yes.
I guess the other case was settled or something.
Subsequently, after the appeal was taken, Kemper did settle the case in the spring of this year. And that's why you don't have briefs from any of the other parties other than Kemper. Their rights were taken care of by reason of the settlement. So now the dispute is just between Kemper and James River.
It's just that they're trying to get a share of their defense costs?
Well, you'd have to ask them, but it would be the defense costs and possibly a portion of the settlement. I don't know.
I see.
That question they can answer. Now, apart from that first exclusion for a prior policy, we have two more exclusions here that we believe are applicable, K and L1. Again, quoted page 11 of our brief. K removes coverage for any claim based on directly or indirectly arising out of or resulting from any conspiracy, intentional breach of contract, or, and we think this is also important, intentional interference with rights or obligations. Then we have exclusion L1. That bars coverage for any claim, quote, based on or directly or indirectly arising out of or resulting from any act committed with knowledge of its wrongful nature. I'll repeat that at the very end. Act committed with knowledge of its wrongful nature. Close quote. These exclusions apply to the allegations in each count of the Terra Nova complaint that the Ranella defendants concealed the malpractice cause of action and that they engaged in a cover-up and conspiracy. These acts were, quote, an intentional interference, close quote, with her rights under exclusion K, and they were actionable only if they were done with knowledge of their wrongful nature under exclusion L1.
But doesn't the complaint allege a failure to disclose the wrongful conduct?
An excellent question, Judge Tinder. And let me answer it this way. Remember that
how does that fit, though? Isn't that a negligent?
Well, it would ordinarily be so if we didn't have a statute of limitations problem. They have to reach back in time. The lawsuit is filed in 2005. Now they're trying to reach back for conduct that took place in 2001. That was the initial failure to transfer the stock options because of the bankruptcy filing. 2001. Now we're ahead 4 years later. For them to be able to go back 4 years in time to get damages for that, they have to allege fraudulent concealment. All right? Under Illinois law, fraudulent concealment. They cannot recover for that negligence without showing fraudulent concealment. Well, fraudulent concealment, as the name implies, is based on the idea that the defendant has intended to deceive.
I'm having a little trouble following that, though. If what they've done here is failed to disclose that they did wrong before, that's a continuing failure, isn't it?
Okay, but the failure to disclose by itself is not actionable as fraudulent concealment. Okay, to be actionable as fraudulent concealment, they have to do something more than that. They have to actually make affirmative representations to deceive, and they have to lull their client into a false sense of security, and she has to detrimentally rely upon that. They cannot fraudulently conceal unless they have knowledge that their acts are wrongful, not merely a, you know, not disclosing, but something more affirmative than that. They have to actually have that guilty knowledge.
But we can only look to the complaint, right?
You can look to the complaint, and you assume those allegations are true. And if I can just make one more point, I see that the yellow light is on. Certainly, under fraudulent concealment theory, there would have to be an intentional interference with her rights, right? Because that's what the whole point is of delaying the filing of the lawsuit. And the last point I would want to make on this is, you know, in many cases, insurance companies stand up here, as I'm doing now, and they point to intentional misconduct, and they say there's no coverage for that. But actually, the plaintiff in the underlying suit can recover by proving something less than intentional misconduct, such as, for example, in defamation cases based on a reckless disregard for the truth. Okay, that's not exactly intentional, and it's covered. And you can recover short of intentional misconduct. But here, the way this complaint was pled, to avoid the statute, they had to allege fraudulent concealment. Fraudulent concealment is essential to their recovery, and that fraud falls within those two exclusions because it's an intentional interference without which they cannot recover. And it is, at least the Tarnovo cannot recover. And it could only be done with guilty knowledge that their acts were wrongful. So, based on the prior policy exclusion, based on exclusion K, based on exclusion L1, we ask you to reverse and to enter judgment for James River. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Reeses. Mr. Rose?
Yes. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Counsel, I plan to spend just 1 second addressing the issue of the fact that the James River policy is, in fact, triggered, and then devote the remaining time to the issues of the three exclusions. With regard to the first point, it's basically conceded that the James River policy is, in fact, triggered, that there were wrongful acts during the policy period of the James River policy, and those wrongful acts were made and reported to James River within the time frame of their policy period.
Those are things that the last two claims that he was referring to?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And those, in fact, are the number...
He agreed with that.
He agreed. Yeah. So now that the policy is triggered, it is now James River's burden. They have the burden of proof of showing that they can bring the claim outside the scope of coverage by demonstrating, and it's their burden to demonstrate, that an exclusion applies to take the claim outside of coverage. With regard to the first exclusion that they've raised, which is exclusion
A2. Why do they have the burden in a suit against another insurance company? I don't understand that.
Well, it's the rule.
I don't understand how they have a burden, you know, if the insured is saying, you know, your policy covers, and they have to prove an exclusion. But in a suit between insurance companies, I don't know why.
Right. It's my understanding, Your Honor, that the rule in Illinois, as it is pretty much across the country, is that with respect to an exclusion from coverage, that it's the insurance company's obligation to demonstrate that an exclusion in their policy applies. I'm not aware of any distinction made as to whether or not it's a claim as between an insured and
an insurer. But why put the burden on the insurance company? I understand.
Because the insurance company is the one that is seeking to avoid coverage under
its policy. The plaintiff, or are you the plaintiff? You're listed on the brief as a counter plaintiff. What's that? What's a counter plaintiff?
In this case.
Yeah, are you really here in the shoes of the Rinellas? Did you step into their shoes by providing them coverage?
We did provide coverage. We did provide coverage and did pay defense costs and also indemnity. But this is an effort to recover the defense costs that we've paid from James River, who also has coverage for the claim.
You're the real plaintiff.
In the sense of,
I mean, realistically,
yes.
You're the plaintiff. So why don't you have the burden of proof?
We have, because
I don't get it. I mean, I understand why insureds are given a break when they get into litigation with insurance company. But when two insurance companies are fighting it out, I would think the burden of proof is on the plaintiff insurance company.
I would explain it like this, that it's essentially tantamount to an affirmative defense that they've raised as to the claim.
I don't understand it. You're saying that these people owe you defense costs. And they say, no, we don't owe you any defense costs. So I think you have to prove they owe you defense costs. Anyway, I don't think it matters.
I think this is a practical matter. They're the ones who have asserted that we don't have to, and they've said the reason we don't have to is because our exclusion applies.
Well, every defendant says, no, I don't have to, right? That's what a defendant says. So you're not going to say defendants have the burden of proof because they're always denying something. That's ridiculous.
But they're not denying.
It's not an affirmative defense, right? This is an insurance policy with exclusions.
It isn't. There is coverage under their policy. They're saying
not
they're
for you.
There is coverage.
Not for you.
They're saying the claim that they're denying that there's coverage.
You're not a beneficiary of their policy.
I'm sorry.
You're not a beneficiary of their policy.
But the denial of coverage is as to their insured.
And you're not the insured. So I don't know why you get the benefit of a burden-shifting rule that's intended for insureds. But anyway, it doesn't matter.
Okay. Case well, the district court treated this as a different claim, didn't he? Or she? I don't remember the judge. Didn't the district court identify these subsequent things that we're talking about as a new claim?
They were definitely separate wrongful acts, namely the failure to keep the client, Mrs. Terranova.
But doesn't that arise out of the original transfer? Or?
Some of the activities do arise out of the original, but in terms of...
I understand. They all do, right? I mean, arising out is pretty broad. Indirectly, I mean, wait, right. It says directly or indirectly arise. What's more... Yeah, directly or indirectly arising from. What could be a broader, a broader statement of cause and effect? As Mr. Reese said, there's no cover-up unless there's something to cover up, which was the original botch, the failure,
It was the negligent failure to advise the client, Mrs. Terranova, that there was this conflict of interest due to their representation of Almaroth in a separate litigation. So that was something that arose later. It was something that they had an ongoing duty to disclose to her. It was a separate wrongful act, and it was a wrongful act.
It's a separate wrongful act, yes, but it arises directly.
It's a conflict. The conflict can become apparent at any time, and the allegations, again, because we're dealing with the allegations in the complaint, specifically indicate that conflict was present, and they had a duty to advise her of that conflict after the Illinois Appellate Court denied, they're on the appeal, that they denied and upheld the rule to show cause finding by the trial court. I think the main point that I would like the court to focus on is the issue of the prior policy, which counsel did make a big issue of. In this context, the Kemper policy is not the prior policy. And the test that essentially James River has advocated this court use is when the policy was issued. That is not the correct test that should be used in this case, because these are claims made and reported policies. There is an extended reporting period under the Kemper policy, and there's a retro date under the James River policy. And in that, for that reason...
So what would be a prior policy within the meaning of this, of the insurance contract?
If you had no overlap of coverage between the two policies. Here you do have overlap. In a claims-made context, the issue is when does the policy provide coverage? From the standpoint of the insured, that's what they're interested in. What is the claim period and when is the period for the wrongful acts? That's why you have a claims-made and reported policy. That's what the insured bought. And that's what these
policies are. I don't understand what you're saying.
Okay. If these were simply occurrence policies, and if you're just simply looking at the policy period, then there would be no coverage under the Kemper policy at all. Why? Because this claim was reported on May 2nd, 2005. But the policy period of the Kemper policy was from 2000 to 2002. So now you're outside of that policy period.
So what? I'm lost. I don't understand.
Okay. The Kemper policy has a 2000 to 2002 policy period.
Yeah, I know the dates. And then there was this later
extended reporting period until 2007. So the only way that you have coverage under the Kemper policy is because the wrongful acts that occurred in 2000 and 2002 could be reported under this extension. So the period of coverage under the Kemper policy is effectively from the 2000 to 2002 period, but then it can be reported until 2007.
Well, that makes sense. I don't understand how you assess a premium and all for that, but if it were just claims made as opposed to occurrence, then the 2000 and whatever it is, 2 to 2004, if somebody just waits for good or bad reasons to make a claim, then you're off the hook, basically, if you don't have this, whatever you call that, extension. So the whole point of that extension is to I guess, to secure the coverage.
Right. And, in fact, the insured paid $48,000 for that extension. If you look at the policy, the policy...
So the insured, in effect, extends the policy, I guess, to cover that period of time. And I assume the next person that's insuring has an inquiry about anything pending or something, I guess. It seems to me if you don't have that extension, the next person to do the insuring might be vulnerable to a lot of things that didn't happen during their watch.
You should have paid the $48,000. So you would screw James. Right? It doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, the important point in terms of determining when
it's too clever to.
Your Honor, the important point with respect to whether the policy, the coverage period is overlapping. So the policies, when two policies overlap as these do, the coverage period overlaps. So if that is the case where it is here, you can't say that one policy is prior vis-a-vis the other. And since these two policies, the coverage period overlaps. So that is why the Kemper policy is not the prior policy. The exclusion does not apply. And then very quickly, with respect to the other...
Whereas it completely defeats the intention behind this clause.
Right.
By prior policy, they mean that you, the insured, they mean by that the insured person, if he has a claim under a prior policy, you know, he's filed the claim, reported the claim, and so on, he can't come after James. He doesn't get two insurance policies. That's what they're saying. So the insureds here did report that, you know, thanks to the extended reporting period, they get to report it and trigger your coverage.
It was reported at the same time under both policies on May 2nd, 2005.
What does it matter? The point is, because of this extended notice period, there was a policy protecting the insured, and that's presumably what prior policy means.
But the policy is that the coverage period overlaps.
So what? What difference does it make?
The difference that it makes.
And they didn't really overlap. It's this extended. Understand, if you're an insured, imagine how you are affected by. Under your view, the insured gets two insurance companies to cover it, right? That's your view.
Protection. Yes, in this
because case, of the happenstance of your having extended the reporting period,
which is what they bought.
Why should that confer this windfall on James's insureds? What sense does it make?
It provides additional coverage.
Well, how are they supposed to protect themselves? They don't want to provide additional coverage. So how is James supposed to draft this so that it doesn't offer insurance for someone who already has insurance?
They could have worded the exclusion differently.
How?
They could have used the word policy period. They could have...
Instead of claims made...
Again, in order to understand what the word
what
prior
What does policy
means,
period mean? You say they're overlapping periods.
Absolutely.
So why would policy period take care of their...
Because that's a defined term under the policy. But this is a coverage period. And if you look at the cases that discuss these issues, in all of those cases, there's no overlapping coverage. In this case, it's distinguishable because in this case, there's overlapping coverage between the two policies. There's no denying that in fact, is the case. And when you have overlapping coverage, the Kemper policy is not prior.
But the only way that works is if these are treated as new claims. That this, what you can call it, an exaggerated claim with all, instead of just negligence, it's fraudulent intent or something. Because that extends it into what the.
Right. All you have to have is wrongful acts.
Huh?
Just wrongful acts, not a new claim. You just need
whatever it is. Though it's claim 5 and 6 or whatever it is down the pike. You're pretty much admitting that whatever the first three are yours, or Kemper's.
No question about it.
Yeah, so, and then, of course, they would try to get out from under their own policy and saying they don't cover fraud or something. And the reason they had to mention fraud is in order to relate back past the statute of limitations, they say.
Right. If you look, so, Your Honor, you're correct that those, they admit that those, the fourth and fifth wrongful acts did occur during their policy period. Those are independent. They did occur during their policy period. Their policies
that's
triggered.
That's what. Right. That's their second argument. The first argument is this all extends back to the first act.
Right. If you look at count three of the third amended complaint, paragraphs 121 to 138, you'll see that there are allegations in that complaint of negligent conduct, not intentional conduct.
Well, what about Mr. Reese's point that to get around the statute of limitations, you had to show fraudulent concealment?
Right. And again, based on the third amended complaint, which is what we're going to look at to determine a duty to defend, there are allegations there in that complaint of non-intentional conduct. And I disagree that you need to have intentional conduct or an intent to defraud or conspiracy.
Well, wait a second. What, you think you have, what, negligent misrepresentation or something? Is that what you're suggesting?
You have the allegations in the complaint that state that they...
What's fraudulent concealment under Illinois law? Does that require deliberate misrepresentation or other deliberate conduct, or can you have negligent misrepresentation?
You can have negligent misrepresentation.
Does that get past statute of limitations?
Yes, because there's also discovery. They are arguing in their complaint or asserting in their complaint against their attorneys that you have a discovery rule that applies and that they're not, the statute of limitations does not begin to run until she discovered that there was this conflict of interest, which wasn't until after the Illinois Appellate Court rendered its decision.
Your discussion of that in your brief is extremely perfunctory. You say these causes, I'm looking at the last page of brief, page 22, these causes of action allege negligence, not conduct intended to cause harm. But I don't see anything about fraudulent concealment being satisfied by proof of a negligent misrepresentation. In fact, I don't see any mention of your whole discussion of K and L, a page and a half. I don't see anything about fraudulent concealment.
And that's because if you look at count three of the Third Amendment complaint, and in particular paragraphs 121 through 138, it's abundantly clear from those allegations in the complaint that it's not intentional conduct.
But Mr. Reese's is saying, rightly or wrongly, I don't know, that as a matter of law, those charges have to involve intentional conduct, or otherwise it's clear on the face of the complaint that they're time barred. And I don't see your response to that argument.
So the response is that the complaint against the Ranella and Ranella law firm asserts a discovery rule and that you do not need to have intentional conduct. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Reese's. Mr. Rose, sorry. I think, does Mr. Reese's time expire? We'll give you a minute anyway if you have something.
Very quickly, prior policy. Hold on one second. Counsel keeps on saying the Kemper policy is not a prior policy and that the coverages overlap. They do not overlap where it counts. Their policy covers wrongful acts that end on September 27, 2002. The extended reporting endorsement doesn't extend the time period for the wrongful act. It ends September 27, 2002. How do we know that? Subparagraph D of the endorsement, which says that it only applies to claims arising out of acts, errors, or omissions prior to the end of the policy period. Prior to the end of the policy period. The declarations. Item 3, policy period. September 27, 2000, September 27, 2002. Any calendar tells you September 27, 2002 is prior to November 8, 2002, which is when our policy picks up coverage for wrongful acts. There is an overlap in the reporting period. There is no overlap as far as what period of time for the wrongful act. The wrongful act for Kemper is ending September 27, 2002. That's prior to our policy period. Counsel talks about it's not the same claim. It's a new claim with regard to acts that take place after November 8, 2002. It's ridiculous. Every count of the complaint is going back to the initial failure to transfer the stock options. We've already gone through that. It's the mother of all wrongful acts. Nothing else happens if the stock is transferred. It wasn't transferred. That happened in their policy period. It was reported in their policy period. It is the common fact or circumstance taking away, therefore our exclusion takes away coverage for that. Let's talk very briefly about exclusions K and L. Counsel talks about it's negligent. Fraudulent concealment is not negligence. It requires something that is intentional and affirmative. And every count is based on fraudulent concealment. Why? Even count three, which they refer to, okay, paragraph 111, which we quoted in our reply brief, has fraudulent concealment allegations, and paragraph 126 has it. And then you go to the last paragraph, paragraph 147. What are they trying to recover for? It's not for the concealment. It's not for the conspiracy. They're trying to recover for the initial failure to transfer the stock options back in July 2001. It all goes back to that original conduct, and that was in their policy period. For all the reasons set forth in our two briefs, and based on our oral argument today, we ask you to reverse and enter judgment in favor of James River. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Reese and Mr. Rose. Very interesting argument.